Shavua Tov, good luck. Posting with Chod Achsanya, I want to extend a big course of Tov to the Shul, Neveinov, Maradasra, Kaufman, Eid Maradas, and Moshe Rubin, who have been extremely helpful in letting this event take place here, helping set things up. Thank you as well to my wife, Ronit, who has allowed me to do this side project and many others at the expense of other things, hopefully not too much of an expense, but she's not only allowed me, but she has been very actively helped set this evening up. A tremendous thank you to Rabbi Gershenfeld and Rabbi Kellerman for agreeing to speak tonight. As I mentioned to some people here, I don't really know that much about my father's writings until a few years ago. I officially got the books as a gift when I was born, and they are on my shelf, so I knew they existed. I think I did read them at some point in high school. But only when I started getting to yeshiva and kollel, moving to Arnof, different places, I'd meet different rabbanim, who I, every time I knew, am taken aback by the kinds of reactions I receive when I mention my father's name. And it's the chizuk from that comes from hearing the things that really, quite frankly, blow my mind. I don't know what Rav Gershenfeld or Rav Kellerman are comfortable with me sharing up here in front of the crowd, what I've heard from them in terms of my father. I've heard from Machon Shlomo guys, how not frequent it is to get Rabbi Gershenfeld to speak, at outside yeshiva events. And there was zero resistance to him speaking at this event. And a big thank you to them. Thank you very much to Gidon and Rivka Jaffa for sponsoring the event. And to that, I turn over to him to introduce the panelists.
Thank you, Chaim. I'm Gidon Jaffa. And I'll get into how I know Rabbi Goldberg in a few minutes. Of course, I echo Chaim's thank you, the Chabot Dachsanya. And I'm going to start with just, I'm going to try and keep this very short because you're not here to listen to me. But growing up, my mother taught us a little ditty, which was, whatever you do, do with your might. Things done by halves are never done right. And she didn't know it, but that was a little bit of Musar teaching that we say every morning in Reishis Chochma about our fathers, but she actually switched it around. You shouldn't, we listen to Shema B'ni Musa Avicha Val Titosh Taras Imecha. So she gave us both Torah and Musar. She also didn't know that she was paraphrasing the Gemara in Brachos, Taf Lamed Beis Amud Beis, Tana Rabbanu. And Rashi teaches us on Tzrichim Chizuk that you should always do things. What does he say? Adam behen tomi b'chol kochu. A person should always engage with all of their might in anything they do. The short introduction I'm going to give for Rabbi Gershenfeld and I'm going to start with the moderator. I'm sorry, and that is the moderator tonight is Rabbi Turetsky, Yehuda Turetsky, and Rabbi Turetsky is the Ram and Rebbe in Shalavim and assistant director of the NCSY Kollel. Rabbi Kellerman served as a lecturer at Neve Yerushalayim between 1996 and 2009. In 2009, he founded the International Organization of Musar, Musar Vadim, an international network of more than two dozen classical Musar Vadim in the USA and Israel. He's the author of dozens of newspaper and journal articles and several books, including Permission to Believe, permission to receive, to kindle a soul, and he's the translator of Rav Shlomo Volbe's Sefer Zriu Uvanim Bechinuch. He's the founder and dean of the Center of Lekeila Development. Rabbi Beryl Gershenfeld is the Rosh Yeshiva of Machon Shlomo, Rosh Yeshiva of Machon Yaakov, and founded the Ma'or campus outreach. And as Chaim told me, he's just a huge force for Kiruv in the last half century here in Israel and in the United States and around the world. And we know this ourselves from having many Bachrim over the years at our Shabbos table who have benefited from Rabbi Gershenfeld's teaching. Rabbi Goldberg. Now he would start as I'm about to. You may not remember this, but the first time I met you was here in Israel at Hebrew University in 1981. You were teaching a course on Rabbi Israel Salanter in Musa. I was here on vacation after my first semester of law school, and I sat in on the class, a couple of classes over there. Just about 2 years later, I bought from Rabbi Goldberg his first book. I believe it was his first book on Israel Salanter in Musa. That was my introduction to Musa. But more than that, we also go back a ways to Denver, Colorado, where I've shared many things. So now going back to the Brisa that my mother inadvertently taught me. These gentlemen, all of them, are powerhouses. They use all of their kohos to teach Torah and bring Torah. For Rabbi Goldberg, I know personally, in terms of all these things, Torah, Maasim Tovim, every Friday night, nowadays, in the shul in Denver, in Idos, he gives a class on Lamites Malachas. He teaches every week when he writes in his newspaper, the Intermountain Jewish News. And he is a teacher whenever he speaks. Maasim Tovim. I know things, I don't want to embarrass him, but there's nothing like an Erev Shabbos call from Rabbi Goldberg, even when I'm here in Israel. The people he's visited in hospitals in very difficult circumstances. And one of the greatest Maasim Tovim, as we all know, is how he cares for his dear wife, Elaine, our dear friend. Torah, Maasim Tovim, tefillin. To watch Rabbi Goldberg daven, the first time I saw him daven, a Rosh Hashanah Maariv, in the shul where we both daven back in Denver, and this is a while ago, was a lesson in Musar in itself, was a limud in how to daven, just to stand and daven. Rosh Hashanah night, Maariv. Amazing thing. Derech Eretz, Lefi, this Brisa, Rashi teaches that that Derech Eretz is your umanis, your skills. To watch Rabbi Goldberg write a Sefer over periods of years, and the one I remember mostly is the one it's actually in two volumes in the back on the Gra, on Mikvayos. But we had discussions about it. I watched him write it. I was able to bring a proof back here for other people to look at. And the intensity and depth with which Rabbi Goldberg writes, thinks, and teaches is something to emulate. And he is the living, breathing part of that Brisa, as are all these gentlemen. So without further ado, we're going to begin the evening. Rabbi Terezin.
First of all, thank you so much for the opportunity to ask questions on Emoti Shabbos. I cannot envision a more enjoyable thing to do. I note the presence of my mother here, who has to put up with for the last close to four decades of me asking questions. And at least here, there's somebody else to answer them, so it's certainly enjoyable for her. I am more than humbled to be up here with the three Rabbanim who are present. When Chaim Goldberg asked me, I somewhat hesitated. I wanted to say yes right away, but thought for a Musar event, I should pretend to be humble and say no. So I waited a good 3 to 5 minutes before I agreed to do so. Leman HaKlal. There is a... It's all three of the Rabbanim who are here. I can't claim that I know any of them personally, but I am a real admirer of Gershenfeld reminiscing. Or I remember close to 20 years ago in Yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael when he came for a Shabbos. Many of the Torahs and insights were very impactful. Rabbi Kalman's writings, I remember from years ago as well. And about 11 years ago, when I was in yeshiva I work, and they were sending me in to interview in different places throughout America, and they asked me where I wanted to go for Shabbos. And they said, any chance you want to go to Denver for Shabbos? So I said, do I get to daven Rabbi Goldberg's shul? So they said, yes. I said, Denver sounds great. So it is a long-time admirer, and it's a real opportunity, and I'm very excited to be able to be here. Some of the questions are going to be to all three Rabbanim, and some of them are going to be more specific. But I guess for the first question, I'm going to avoid, at least for now, the question of what is Mussar. I'm nervous that would take a long time, so we're going to avoid that particular question. I want to shift it towards the title a little bit. Rabbi Saul Salanter began, whatever that means, a Mussar movement. He did so presumably because he perceived a particular need in society, in the firm world, in the yeshiva world, to strengthen, to emphasize particular ideas. The first question I would have for all three Rabbanim is, to what extent is Mussar necessary nowadays? Is there a particular need, is there a particular tzorech that people have to learn Mussar in our time? To frame the question a little bit differently, there are a lot of other svarim out there. A person could learn Chassidus, a person could read self-help books. What is it about Mussar that is relevant in 2023?
Before I begin, I want to thank my son Chaim for arranging this unbelievable evening. I want to thank Rabbi Gershenfeld for his tremendous dedication and success in raising up Talmidim in an unbelievable way, with not only dedication, but with wisdom. I go back to, with Rabbi Gershenfeld from before he was married, and I've watched him develop over the decades and seen what he's done. It's amazing, and it's what Klal Yisrael needs, and I want to thank you personally. I want to thank my colleague, Rabbi Kellerman, for all he does around the world in Mussarvaden. And as I said to him earlier, we're meeting for the first time, just the title of his book, Permission to Believe. What a powerful message. What a cutting through tons of unclarity. That's a contribution that's going to last for the generations. So it's a great honor to be here with you. I want to hope that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will give you the strength to keep doing all of this good work. So what is the what's the particular role of Mussar today? Let me answer on two levels. Number one might be a surprising level, but we live in polarized times. The polarization in the United States is tremendous, and I see also in Israel polarized times. And what's the definition of polarization? The definition is, I'm right. Whatever side that you stand on the political spectrum, it all comes down to those words. I'm right. And what Mussar says is, challenge your convictions. Mussar says, don't be so certain you're right. You might be right. We're not saying you're not right. But analyze it. Don't take for granted that what you feel instinctively or reflexively is in fact what you ought to be feeling. Mussar says, take a step back. Mussar says, be a little bit humble. Be a little bit skeptical. Be a little bit willing to not necessarily accept your original or your instinctive responses to things. And I think that if we had a little bit more of that Mussar, or a little bit more of that capacity for skepticism, self-skepticism, we'd have a lot less polarization and a lot healthier society. And so that's really, if we had to boil it down, he said, well, he's not going to ask what Mussar is, but you can't avoid that question. And if we had to boil it down, it's really taking a step back, not going with your instinct, not going with your first impression, which could end up being correct. Not a problem. Could be. But it has to be a consequence of some careful thinking, and thinking which is difficult, because the most difficult thinking is that which challenges what you think is right. Challenging it to yourself is the most difficult thinking. If we had a lot more of that, I think we'd have a lot less polarization. Okay, but within a different context, within the context of how we go about our lives as observant Jews, you know, we get up in the morning, we daven, go through life, do whatever it is we're doing, try to study some Torah along the way, try to do some chesed along the way. The critical point is now the same as it has always been. We're really not in any different boat in the year 2023 than we've been forever. And that is, are we acting with integrity? Are we doing the best we can? Are we doing the right thing? Well, you know, it's very easy to convince yourself you're doing the right thing. I'm giving chesed, I'm giving tzedakah, I'm davening, I'm going to shul. Of course I'm doing the right thing. Well, am I really doing the right thing? Am I doing as best I can? Have I challenged myself to do better? Am I davening with kavana? Do I have the capacity to have more kavana? Am I growing? Am I different than I was before? You know, there's a I think, fairly common phenomenon that comes around Elul, comes around Rosh Hashanah, comes around time for tshuva. How many people feel, oh, last year I made resolutions to do all these things. This year, somehow or another, I'm in the same boat. All the things that I said last year, I'm going to improve. All the things that I said last year, I'm going to change. All the things I said last year, I'm going to do better. And lo and behold, I'm sitting fighting the same struggles. So what Musar is, it's a sense that I must put more into it. I can't just come back to where I was. I have to be able to say I'm different from where I was. My tefillah is different. My chesed is different. I learned from Reuven sitting here in the first row, who I met for the first time a couple of days ago. Such a beautiful concept. I'll embarrass him, okay? I've been embarrassed tonight, so I'm going to pay back. He carries around quarters because as he walks down the street, he sees parking meters with red lights flashing. And when those red lights are flashing, the owner of the automobile is going to return. He's going to be very unhappy to pay a $30 or $50 or $70 parking ticket. And he drops the quarters in. And nobody knows that he did it. And nobody knows what he's doing. And the person gets back to his car and he's not paying $50 or $70. To be able to devise ways, new ways in one's life to do chesed. This is among the things that one does when one looks at the world with a Musar perspective.
Rishis, there's no question that every generation has unique challenges. I think it's also true that this generation could classify itself, we can call ourselves, a generation in crisis. I say that globally. I'm speaking here specifically about the Jewish community, although it's true of the larger world as well. We are a generation in crisis, and you could point to the miniature versions of this crisis in many areas of our lives. If you would start at the heart of things, we have a Shalom Bayis crisis. If you would sit with me while I counsel couples, you would see many repeating themes, but one theme that repeats over and over again, and this really echoes what Rabbi Goldberg was stressing, is selfishness. We're a generation that is suffering terribly. We're infected with a terrible disease of selfishness, and it's causing untold pain in our marriages. Sometimes it bubbles up to the surface in divorce. We see those numbers popping up statistically, but even where there isn't divorce, the Jewish community and the frum community is a community that is relatively in crisis, meaning relative to previous periods in history. Before we ever get to marriage, we've all heard of something called the Shidduch crisis. So it's hard to know which side of the line to point to, but certainly there's a certain amount of selfishness going into marriage. I expect you to meet my needs. And that slows down the process. But it's more than that. We're a giant community. And if every one of us took responsibility, there would be no need for shadchanim. We'd all be shadchanim. We're busy. And that's a nice way of saying that this person who's not married and is suffering terribly as a result is not my priority. And as a result of that, there are thousands and thousands of Jews who are suffering terribly. We've heard a lot about the off the derech crisis. So again, when you counsel people who are off the derech, you hear crazy stories. Again, how much can you believe? Eid Echad, who knows? But some of what we hear about the way that these people interacted, the people who are off the derech, the way they interacted, the experiences that they had with teachers or with parents, makes them sound much more like they were pushed off the derech. It's not true in every single case. But to say that there's no element of selfishness in that phenomenon, I think would be an inaccurate read of the picture. Then there's the people coming back to Klal Yisrael, the Kiruv movement. And here I'm not an expert. I worked for a few years at Neve Yerushalayim. When I worked at Neve Yerushalayim, I taught about 900 women per day at Neve Yerushalayim. I taught in every program that they had, and the place was packed. There are not 900 women at Neve Yerushalayim today. There's not 800, there's not 700, there's not 600, there's not 500, there's not 400. There's many explanations for what's happening. I don't think it would be inaccurate to say that the Talmidos have changed. More selfishness, less altruism. What's in it for me? As opposed to what can I contribute or what's expected of me? But on the other side also, we don't have the same product to offer to the secular that we had 20 years ago or 30 years ago. Today there are seminaries and yeshivas that have Shabbos whitelists. They're not blacklists. A blacklist would be much more encouraging. Places where you can't send a Baal Tshuva for Shabbos. It's an unusual Jewish family and you don't want them exposed to that. We have whitelists, places where it's recommended that you send people. They'll have a very good experience at this place or at that place. It's not that you can just open the door and say, it's a wide, broad Orthodox Jewish community. Go any place and you'll have an amazing experience. We're suffering a mental health crisis. My wife works in the field. I don't know names, I don't know profiles. But I know the pain, the anxiety, the depression, the disorders that people suffer from, often because of selfishness. Sometimes their own selfishness, sometimes the selfishness in the environment. We're in crisis. And the good news is, this is a very dark presentation, I apologize. But the good news is that there is Torah Latim Tumalev. There's a special Torah that melts selfishness and transforms it into love. There's a Torah that brings light into people's lives in a serious and permanent way. And if there was ever a generation that was in need of the sort of Torah that Rabbi Goldberg has made famous over the decades, it's this generation. And people are as responsive, at least as responsive in this generation of Musar as they were in previous generations. I dare say there are more people who are seriously devoting time to Musar in this generation than perhaps in any generation since the time when Ariso Salanter tried to popularize the Limud. So the good news is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us the refuah before the Makkah, and the refuah is extremely effective. And Baruch Hashem, the Torah of Musar is exactly what this generation needs, perhaps more than any other generation.
It's great having such a wonderful panel of friends. We all have such different perspectives. I'm going to try and not be affected by what both of you said and just respond as Rav Turetsky asked the question beginning, and as my wife directed me to respond when we talked about this in my house. And my wife came up and kind of said, Musar in 2023, well, what was Musar in 2022? What was Musar in 1880? And kind of the way Rev Turetsky asked the question, what was Rev Yisrael Salanter thinking of when he began the Musar movement? And I think that's, I didn't think as broadly as the two of them, but I think what Rev Yisrael was thinking of, if you read Tenuas of Musar, Volume 1, Reb Dov Katz, which is where Rev Ruderman sent me to understand what the Musar movement was, is that Rev Yisrael felt that the creativity and the vision and the idealism of Klal Yisrael had been crushed, had been compressed, and we had to connect to deeper and broader visions of Judaism, especially because of the opening of the ghetto and the fact that the worldview of people was a broader worldview of emancipation. And he expresses over there at the beginning that Rav Yisrael, Rav Dov Katz says, Rav Yisrael said that we have to know that Judaism is not a religion, and that what Musar in that vision came for was that there's a mission of Ben Adam Lemakom, as Pirkei Avos starts off, Torah starts on Torah, Voda, Gemilas, Chasadim. The morale says foundationally that there's three different ways to express our Yiddishkeit. Religion, Rav Dov Katz says over there, is a relationship between man and the Eibishter. There's a second relationship of people learning Torah. There's a third relationship of man, Adam ben Adam la'atzmo. Who am I as a person, and how do I relate to my society? I think Reb Yisrael felt that that old aspect of Yiddishkeit, of course expressed by Chovas Levavos and expressed for generations, had gotten lost. And therefore Reb Yisrael put on the perfection of man as an essential vision of Torah, and perfection of community as an essential vision of Torah. And by doing that, thought he would inspire everyone to a deeper vision of Torah and a deeper vision of self. I remember specifically myself kind of being in this way as Reb Hillel and I were, he was 5 or 6 years before me in the process of growing. I was always looking behind him as he was making decisions before I was. But I specifically remember being in a certain place, the town we were in, and there was a Rebbe who was close to Ben Adam Lamakom, and there was a Rav who was close to learning Torah. And I remember a Rav, Rav Kalman Rosenbaum, who was the day school principal in Hartford where I was, who talked about Ben Adam Lamakom. It was the first time I heard of this idea, and he told it over from his Rebbe, who was Kalmer, the Mashgiach of Ner Yisrael. And this aspect of Ben Adam La'atzmo and Ben Adam L'chavero in the world, that's the aspect that Reb Yisrael wanted to bring to the world. And he brought it in many, many different ways. And of course, that's the most important thing I think that Torah world needs to see, the power of Torah. And once we get that, now we can think more broadly like Rev Hillel did and Rev Leib did. And now, of course, that's what society needs. It's not just our marriages aren't working, their marriages aren't working. It's just not our society can't speak to each other, their society can't speak to each other. And we become a real Or L'Goyim when we work and get that right and realize there's more than just Adam L'Makom and Adam L'... There's an Adam L'Atzmo and Adam L'Chavera to spread that Yiddishkeit out. That's very powerful. That's the message that Rebbe Yisrael had. To me, that's what inspires me in almost everything I do. That vision, I think, is what inspires a generation. And the way to resolve all problems is focus on yourself, focus on other people, That's going to come, of course, from the wisdom of Torah, come from connection with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. But that's what Rabbi Yisrael speaks to me. And that's what inspires me, and I think it inspires a generation. I wasn't going to speak as universally and dramatic as Rav Hillel did, but I always liked that there is a African-American dean at Penn. Sam knows him, Shmuel knows him. We can go together. A wonderful Chaz Howard. So I think the only time I've heard an American dean use the word Musser was this 6'6", wonderful, sensitive, I think, Christian chaplain, dean, says, Rabbi Gershenfeld, I have to give you Musser. You don't know how much Maor changes all of campus. When we get Jewish students talking about ideals and ethics, it changes everybody else. And you're insensitive to how the fact that ethics and ideals aren't talked about in campus. He says, Maor is not just good for the Jewish students to take it, but it's good for changing the whole campus discussion. I think that's what we're all trying to talk about, and that's what Rabbi Yisrael wanted to do.
Well, thus far we've been speaking about Musser more generally. There are definitely different schools of thought within the Musser movement. I guess for the next question is first a question for Rabbi Goldberg and then a follow-up for Rabbi Kalman and Rabbi Gershenfeld. For Goldberg, would it be possible to, I guess, briefly articulate some differences between the various schools? I think many people here, maybe this is just me, Slobodka as Godless Ha'adam and Nevarik as Shifas Ha'adam, I think I'm missing the next sentence about what else are the differences between them and what those terms may mean. So I guess a brief understanding of some differences, and I would love if Rabbi Gershenfeld and McKellerman to reflect upon, in dealing with Talmidim, are there particular schools of thought, particular ideas that one either avoids nowadays or Dafka emphasizes nowadays in Talmidim and their own sort of growth process?
Are there different schools of Musar thought? The answer is yes and no. First, yes. We have a history. We have rabbis. We come from a tradition. Rabbi Gershenfeld referenced many times Rabbi Zolotar, the beginner of the Musar movement in the modern period. And he had certain Talmidim. And these Talmidim went in different directions. One was Rabbi Yitzhak Blazer, one was Rabbi Avraham Schenker, one was the altar of Slobodka, one was the altar of the Vardik, and they had different approaches. You referenced Godless Adam and Shiflus Adam. These, in my humble opinion, are oversimplifications. Let me share with you a rather shocking incident. We associate the term Godless Adam, the greatness, the majesty of the human being, with the altar of Slobodka and with the yeshiva that he founded, which continued on through the Chevron Yeshiva up to this day. And Godless Adam sounds wonderful, sounds sweet. Once the altar was sitting with a student, they were in a isolated room. There was one candle illuminating the room. That is to say, it was already pretty dark. The altar reaches over, puts out the candle. It's now pitch dark. And he says, it's forbidden to look into the face of a Russia. This would never happen today. Maybe it never happened. Maybe it happened only once in the history of the Slobodka Yeshiva. But the point is the same. We can't just take these little phrases and feel that we understand what's happening. The altar was a complex person and a very serious person. If people have read here the autobiography of Dov Cohn and his memoir of the Chevron Yeshiva, when it came to this country in 1924, you see it was a very serious place. There were no diversions. There were no Motzi Shabbases at, at the pizza place. They didn't go to Jerusalem to take a little bit of a break. It was learning all the time. It was a very serious place. and in some respects a severe place. And yes, the altar talked about the godless Adam, and he modeled it. And many great people came out of that yeshiva. But it wasn't simple, okay? So we have Shiflus Adam. So Shiflus Adam, the lowliness of man, well, this supposedly, the reference there is to the Navardic Yeshiva. I'm a student of the Navardic Yeshiva. Well, I was privileged to know Reb Yitzchok Orlansky. Reb Yitzchok Orlansky in 1939 was standing in a train looking through the window, and he saw his wife and he saw four of his five children, and he waved goodbye and he never saw them again. They died in the Ponar gas chamber. One son he was able to rescue. And then he spent 6 years in Siberia. Then he came to the United States and was a fish out of water. He was in a different culture. Reb Yitzchok Orlansky was the happiest person I've ever known. You know how when you get people who are older, the lines in their face sort of reflect who they are? Reb Yitzchok Orlansky's lines in his face always showed a smile. He didn't have to smile. His mouth could be closed. The smile was permanently imprinted on his face. This was a person who supposedly was a result of yeshiva, where they put people down and they talked about the lowliness of man. So it's more complex. It's not so simple. We can't go back to the history of the yeshiva and say, oh, well, here they talked about godless Adam and here they did shiftless Adam. So you asked originally, can we go through the history? Yes, we can go through the history, and I've outlined the history in a very brief and oversimplified way in of itself, given the time constraints here. And I said it's relevant and it's not relevant. It's relevant, yes. We go back, we learn from great people, we learn from great role models. They left much, much Torah that we can learn from. I learned from many great people. I learned from Ben Sion Brook and from Orlansky and Rabbi Yoman Zilber and others, great people. But it's also irrelevant. It's very important to say it's irrelevant, because the Musar that we need to write, the Musar that we need to practice, the Musar that we need to be is something that has to relate to our lives right here and now, us. We can't just say, well, I'll pattern myself after somebody who dealt with the crises of a previous generation. We have to deal, as you articulated so well, with the crises of our generation. We have to be Baali HaMusar. We have to be people who are relating Bein Odom La'atzvo, fashioning ourselves into the right kind of people to deal with the crises that we have right now. Yes, we can learn from the role models of the past. Yes, we have no other place to turn for getting our basic learning other than to the role models of the past. We have to do it ourselves. We can't just push it onto others. And the crisis that we have, and the lives that we have, not just crises sort of generally out there, but the crises or the issues, not necessarily a crisis, but the issues that we need to deal with, each in our own lives, that has to be today. That can't just be the Navardic pattern or the Slobodka pattern or the Kelm pattern. That has to be the pattern that we have the courage to look at through the lens of our own challenges.
I heard Rav Olba, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, echo what Rabbi Goldberg is describing, but it's not so simple. And he said that when the Baali Musar were facing a Talmid who had low self-esteem, he needed a certain remedy. When they were facing a Talmid who had reasonable self-esteem, but perhaps a lack of humility, then a different refuah was necessary. Different communities had different qualities, and therefore, he said, that all of the Talmidim of Rav Yisrael Salanter who were trying to bring people to a state of shlemus, of perfection, adjusted their approach to the profile of the community, and specifically the profile of the individual they were facing. bringing it into this year, 2023. There are certain widespread breaks in our spirituality that need to be repaired. They're very common. For example, many people walk around with enormous guilt and therefore have a very difficult time believing that Hashem loves them, that He wants them back, that He's waiting for them, that He relates to them like their own firstborn child, that He would have no intention of taking revenge upon them for their misbehavior. That's a very difficult thing for people to internalize today, and therefore they need an approach which not only models that sort of love, but which helps the person plant it inside of themselves. For example, and now I'm segueing to a second point, the way that we learn Musar Bizman Hazeh, for many people, will be different than the way that Musar was learned in previous generations. It was always necessary for people to be aware of their strengths, because as Rabbi Yochanan Lubavitch used to say, that our strengths are the tools that we use to repair our weaknesses. Today, when we learn Musar, it's dangerous to pick up a Mesilas Yesharim, start reading along, and find the first place where my personality diverges from the ideal of the Mesilas Yesharim, and then dwell on that for a while. And then move to the next place where my personality differs with the ideal and dwell on that for a while. I'll be shattered by the Sefer. It'll destroy me. And therefore, the way that Revolba recommended that people with that weakness, which I have, read the Mesilas Yesharim, at least for the first 10 years, he said. For the first 10 years, he said, that's the beginning. In the first 10 years, he said, read along in the Mesilas Yesharim until you find a section that's describing a perspective that you have once held, or a maisa that you once did, or some other maila that you possessed, you possessed or you still possess. And he said, when you find the Mesilas Yesharim describing you, pause in front of that mirror and review that piece over and over and over again, clarifying for yourself what this piece of Torah looks like and how it's resident inside of you. Then continue reading until you find the next section of the Mesilas Yesharim that describes your strengths. And then dwell on that over and over and over again until you get complete clarity that yes, you do possess this. Part of the Musar program, segueing to a third point, was always Cheshbon HaNefesh. So in the old days, people did a Cheshbon HaNefesh on their entire life, every single day. Today, that might be above our reach. Today, maybe we'll just make a Cheshbon HaNefesh on one or two or three avodos that I'm putting my entire heart and soul into, things I could really succeed at. Very small, microscopic mycene that I try to accomplish every single day that I can see success with. Revolba recommended that we do a Cheshbon HaNefesh Biksav, that we actually have a written record. And he had a fascinating insight. He said, when you chart your success in your Cheshbon HaNefesh, when you're successful, you put a check in a box, I did it. He said, if that day you're not successful in that avoda, you don't put an X in the box. An X would indicate a failure. He said, first of all, you don't know that not doing the avoda that day was a failure, because there's a much larger pattern. It could be that I used to go 10 days before getting a success, and now I've got it down to I only go 9 days before getting a success. And in a few weeks, I'll have it down to 8 days, which means every one of those empty boxes is still part of my success. The pattern is positive. And more than that, I'm not a failure when I'm trying to maintain a consciousness of my avoda, and today I wasn't successful in accomplishing it. I'm in process. I'm on my way. The most important thing are those checks. And this leads to another concept. Rav Vogel told us, never throw out your cheshbon nefesh, never throw out your charts. I have a large packet of charts from many years. Why? Because the Yetzer's greatest tool is Yeush. He says, Leib, you know, you've never been successful in changing. You've never been successful in growing. You failed consistently over the years. And when he says that, I say, oh yeah? Take a look at this chart from 10 years ago. That was a mess. 5 years ago, much better. Look at this year. This year's looking even better than that. The whole approach builds me up against the attacks of the Yetzer, so I won't go into Yeush. Rav Vogel said that many people say that Musar is a negative approach to human beings. He said, people who say such a thing know nothing about Musar. It's all about bringing someone to Shlemus, and Bizman Hazeh, bringing someone to Shlemus means building them up, helping them realize Hashem loves them, that they can keep mitzvahs, that it's shayach to go 24 hours without doing a chet. That's a tremendous chiddush for many people. It could take years in avad before someone actually realizes, you know what, I can go 24 hours without doing a chet. It happens, sometimes a week. That's a tremendous chizik, and that's the kind of chizik that our generation needs. That's the kind of chizik that's provided by Musar Bizman Hazeh.
I think the first part is, yeah, Musar is messy. You can't make strong categorical statements about different schools of Musar like Rav Hillel started with. I like myself, there's Rav Ari Levine writes an introduction to the Leshen, and he explains very beautifully that Rav Shlomo Eliashiv, the great Kabbalist, after studying Rav Yisrael's Talmidim, as Rav Hillel expressed, he said that he's decided that the job of a Musar Rebbe, the job of Rebbe Yisrael, the mission was to be like the Gemara in Baba Basra, Daf Tes Vav Amid Beis, that the Kodesh Baruch Hu Sam Evan Tova Al Tzavara Shel Avram Fakolosh Histakol Bo Nisrapa, that there is a beautiful diamond, beautiful stone around Avram Avinu's neck. Everyone who looked at it, they were immediately cured. And you get cured in different ways. A person is supposed to have a depth of his Torah and depth of his life that brings an Evan Tova, something inspirational to everybody. And the word Evan comes from the word Aleph Beis, something foundational. If we talk about foundations, people desire that in Misrad Misrapa. And the Reb Arya Levine continues in the name of the Leshem. The Leshem said to him that you see that Naftali Amsterdam was a tzaddik. He wasn't a mechanech, and he wasn't a posik. Rabbi Yitzhak Blazer was the posik for Moscow. He took his kochos a different way. It was a real Talmud of Rabbi Yisrael. He says, the Alter Mikelm, he was a mechanech. And each person saw something in Musar, and that applied to them and moved them in a deep way. That's what I think all great Musar Rebbes are trying to do. There may be simple formulas we put around them, but the mission is to live a deep life and communicate a deep life and see how that helps actualize the different personalities in front of them. In my own family, my wife's grandfather, Reb Shimon Schwab, he would always say that his Rebbe for life was Rev Yerucham Levavitz, the great Mashgiach of the Emir. And he said, Rev Yerucham did Musar with Musar. I do Musar with Tefillah. I live with Tefillah. And he says, I hope that the way I approach Musar is from the way Rev Yerucham taught me to learn Musar. That's why I do with Tefillah. And that's what a wise educator and a wise Baal Musar is trying to do with everyone, have an Evan Tova to inspire people to bring out their own kochos where they're going. That being said, all of my connections to Masorah, whether it's Rav Moshe Shapiro, whether it's Rav Shlomo Volpe, whether it's Rav Rudiman, whether it's Rav Huttner, that the problem of the door, Rav Huttner explains many times in the Agaros, that the problem of the door is a lack of appreciation of our Evan Tov, our foundation of life, the olive base of life, that we're made B'Tzelem Elohim, that we have greatness, and we have ideals, and we have wisdom, we have free choice, and that there's a Mesorah that was given over through the altar, but a Mesorah that the first thing to work in is godless Adam. And as Rev Leib said, someone who thinks Mussar is negative, when certain people, Hasidim, walk up and they tell me, oh, Mussar is negative, I kind of look at them like, you know, here's an Orit Suflin, please do me a favor. Like let's just, what are you talking about? What do you think? I'll show you in a Tanya how negative and bittul and self-nullification it is. If you read it for real, like, come on, people, like, someone's not reading the whole text over here. But the Mesorah I have is that Mesorah that what to focus on is the Aleph Beis, the Evan Tova, is we've got greatness, we've got free will, we have a Tzelem Elohim of goodness implanted in us. We're living a generation after Darwin and after Freud and after mass culture that's destroyed godless Adam. And that's the foundation to begin with. I think that's where probably the Evan Tova, the beginning, has to grow, and I'm going to... That's what I understand. Rav Volbit told me once in a conversation, it's a little bit, but not as strongly said in Ali Shur Beis, that he told me that it's over. It was paskind. You see that the altar worked on something that Rav Yisrael Salanter told him to work on godless Adam. And you saw that all the Gedolim came from that aspect. He says, someone who debates this, it's like after Pesach of the Shulchan Aruch, he said. He says, you look at the Gedolim, and that he produced, and there's a psak that the Aleph Beis of Mussar in our generation, I think, is to try and help a person recognize the Tzelem Elohim and the Evan Tov inside of him.
All of the Rabbanim here, at least based on my understanding, have been zochet to personal relationships, at least on some level, with great Bali Mussar. Interactions, personal conversations in which they were able to learn directly from some real experts that were familiar with and able to give over yisodos from the world of Mussar. Somebody who's in the audience right now that does not have that kind of exposure, what would be a good first step if they decide they want to start entering the world of Mussar? There's something about Mussar, and maybe this is just me, maybe I'm misreading it. There's something about Mussar which seems incredibly accessible. I can go to any Sfarim store and I can buy Sifrei Mussar. There are some amazing works of Mussar in the back of the room. And there's also something which seems almost inaccessible to an outsider. It seems almost, and again, maybe I'm wrong, but it requires an element of personal, I guess, connection. Or a Mesorah, like many elements of our of how the world of Torah functions. So I guess, what would be recommended first steps for somebody that decides they want to enter in a more serious way to that world of Mussar?
This is a very easy question to answer. The first step is right here, Rabbi Gershenfeld. The first step is right here, Rabbi Kellerman. Done. I finished with the answer. People used to ask me, oh, how did I have a relationship with these great people that I had a relationship with that I've written about? It's very simple. I knocked on the door and asked. It's really that simple. If you want to have a relationship with a great person, knock on the door. We have here in the holy city, where Naftali Kaplan in the Yeshiva Nativa Das, is a great Baal Mussar is alive today, gives a vod, I don't know, once a week, twice a week, three times a week, I don't know exactly. He's here, knock on the door. I think there's another critical issue. As Rabbi Yisrael pointed out, a Baal Mussar is not just a male. A Baal Mussar is also equally potentially a female. The great role model does not have to be somebody who occupies an official position in a yeshiva. It could be, my role model is Rabbi Nafli Kaplan's wife, Rabbi Chaya Kaplan. I'll tell you a little story. When Rabbi Elia Lopian came to this country, He retired. He came at the age of 65 or something like that. He went to meet the Brisker Rav. He wanted to meet the Brisker Rav. He'd spent all these decades in England. He wanted to meet the Brisker Rav. So he went to meet him, went to his house, knocked on the door, and they sat. And they sat together for a half hour. And not one single word was exchanged between them. And then Rav Lupian got up to leave. And when he got up to leave, the Brisker Rav accompanied him to the door, and out the door, and to the stairs, and down the stairs, and out to the street. And whether it was his children, his Talmidim, said to him, "We've never seen you pay so much respect to somebody. Why did you do that?" His answer was, "I didn't know that somebody like that was still alive." And they had not exchanged one word. When I sit with, I'm embarrassing you, we're not Balei Mussar tonight. We're busy embarrassing people. So I'm now going to embarrass Reb Chaya Kaplan. When I sit with Reb Chaya Kaplan, I don't know, we're talking about whatever the weather. It doesn't make any difference what it is. I say to myself, wow, I didn't know that somebody like that was still alive. Look for the people. They're here. There's probably a good few in this room. You want to know how? Just knock on the door. Open your eyes. Look and see the special people. And Baruch Hashem, they're amongst us. How do we know they're amongst us? I'll tell you another story. Back in Sanhedrin Rechevet, at the beginning of the neighborhood in the 1970s, there was a tiny little area that we wanted to have for a playground. There was no playground in the neighborhood. And so we met with one of the city councilors. His name was a man named Reb Shmuel Shalson. Reb Shalson in here in Arnof is named after Reb Shmuel Shalson, a wonderful man. He died young, wonderful man. And he was, I forget whether he was in the Knesset or the city council or something. And he came out and he was going to try to help us get this little playground. So among the things he said when asked about, I don't remember what, he was asked about something that required a Pesach Halacha, and he says, "Well, look, we live in an orphan generation. There's no more Brisker Rav. There's no more Chazon Ish." This is the 1970s. The Brisker Rav died in 1959. The Chazon Ish died a few years earlier. You know, we're an orphan generation. There's nobody to ask. Okay. At that time, alive, living, was Rav Avadi Yosef, Rav Eliashiv, Rav Vosner, and so many others. But we're focused on the previous generation, so nobody looked as good as the previous generation. But look at these great Gedolim were alive. Rav Eliashiv, Rav Avadia. So you know what? We don't have the Saba of Slobodka. We don't have the Saba of Navardik. We don't have Rabbi Rucham. We have other people. Just have to open your eyes. Look around. They're here.
First, I just have to echo what Rav Goldberg said. When I first was an Avreich here in Yerushalayim, I met Rav Olba, and I assumed it would be impossible to get access. But you could go to Rav Olba's house and knock on the door, and he would open the door and sit and talk with you. There were hours, but there was no gabbai trying to stop you. There was no gate. There was no list. And obviously, there's no need to describe what it would be like to walk into his house and watch him and how he behaved and how he welcomed and how he took care of his wife when she brought home the groceries on a Tuesday night. I was zochet to live during a time when Rosh Hashanah Zalman Orbach graced the streets of Yerushalayim. And you could walk him home from Mincha and go into his house and ask him shailas. Rav Olba told me that the Gedolim, the people who we should be accessing, Hashem makes sure that they're accessible. We can get to them. If they're behind bars, then you don't need to speak to them. Every now and then someone asks me, should I meet? If I want to meet a real Baal Musar Bizmanazeh, who should I meet? So, because Rav Goldberg said we have permission to embarrass people tonight. I cannot tell you how many people I've told, go to Denver. There's a newspaper editor there you have to meet. The first exposure that I had to Rabbi Goldberg was I davened in a minyan with him. And I saw him in the minyan, and I realized this is the real deal. So there are people, there are special people in our generation that it's kedai to meet. That has an enormous impact on somebody. Then there's the formal practice of Musar. As I mentioned before, that's also uniquely available in our generation. There's an entire group of Rabbanim in America. They're part of the International Organization of Musarvad, and they will fly to any city in North America that has a group of people who want to start practicing Musar. And they have Musar Vadim literally in dozens of cities across America. Enormously accessible. Here in Yerushalayim, a few days ago, I witnessed a group of, it was more than 60 men who had never been exposed to the practice of Musar previously, come to their first VOD meeting. They plan on meeting forever. They have no intention of making this a short-term experience. And it's not just men. Rav Goldberg said there's Bali Musar who are women. I saw a few weeks ago a group of also about 60 plus women who enrolled in a VOD here in Harnof. And they'll be meeting every 4, 5, 6 weeks to work on themselves. Again, with no end in sight, they have no intention of doing this for a month or two or six. They're looking for something to do for life. The Masorah is accessible. Again, it's just the Yetzirah that makes us feel like it's amorphous, it's out there someplace, but we can't get to it. But it's not the case. Ribono Shel Olam provides every generation with exactly what they need.
I'm open to learning perspective over here. I do remember once Rav Volba sitting down and telling us in a vad that there were 5 Bali Musar left in Eretz Israel who had a Masorah from Europe, and it was our obligation to go find them. And he listed off 5 people who were all were old at the time. And Rav Volba told me I had to go. You live in Harnof, you have to go to Rav Mordechai Zuckerman. That's what we have to make a relationship with. And as we explained, it knocked on the door, walked in, and developed a connection. But I really do grapple with the issue of the difficulty of trying to find a Musar Rebbe to start you off. I think it was one of my difficulties when I started my process of Torah in America, maybe before Rabbi Kellerman's influence and before Rabbi Goldberg's Sforum, that I had to grapple with this, that I looked around and I thought I was the only one who was nuts, that I was interested in the Torah Samusar, self-development, societal change, vision of Torah, and I didn't find so many people that were open to that at that time. And I think that 2 key ideas helped me through that period of time. One was, I think everyone has to have a live Rebbe and a dead Rebbe. So I made a sefer. You look around Sforum, and we find a sefer awakens you and resonates with you. That sefer's got to be your dead Rebbe. He can be there all the time, and that speaks to your heart and speaks to your neshama, and you become an expert at that sefer, and it can speak to you if you chazer it and live life with it in a way that's very powerful. Perhaps in our time, for a person who's unaware of the tools of Musar, it could be the 2nd volume of Ali Shor, where Rav Volba works on specific midos and really does what he would do in the Vadim at the Vadim Musar, at Beis HaMusar, what he would do there, and a person can get a feel for it and read it through and have it. And then to pick up times when he can relate, a visit with a gadol, a visit with a person who's deep, Unfortunately, those meetings often are too brief to really lay out a structure for a person to grow in Mussar. But they turn back the curtain to allow you to see a depth of a personality, the nonverbal aspects, as Hillel was saying, about just looking at each other and understanding what's going on underneath the words. And those can be glimpses, they're stars, they awake in the night, they're lightning. But for most people, it's hard to find someone who's going to really be their Rebbe. It could be the people in Rev Leib's Vad who go out and do it can help you their way through. But I find usually that there's not enough time of great people to really work with you on practical details. And that's a real problem. And oftentimes, even a person who's great at Mussar has a different personality than you do. And if I think that person's going to be my Rebbe, it's hard for me to accept that that's it. If I accept it as a lightning in the sky that illuminates something, that can go on. But to find a Mussar Rebbe is very hard in this generation, I think. Probably one has to develop, as I was fortunate to develop in yeshivas, a relationship long-term with a Rebbe to be there. But I think it's a difficult situation facing those people. And the answer is probably somewhere between Reb Leib's Vadim for people going out and Reb Hillel's Svarim to give you a sense of what that is, while also knocking on doors for those short-term lightning flashes.
I think just given the time is maybe the last question. I'm definitely struck sitting up here looking at the crowd as far as the range of people that are clearly interested in learning and hearing about Mussar. I attempt not to be too superficial, but there seems to be a range of age and hashkafa throughout the crowd, and certainly a lot of people in general. There are a lot that are, I'm sure, interested in engaging in a serious way in the world of Mussar. For a lot of people, let's say maybe those who are not here tonight, the world of Mussar is somewhat scary. It's somewhat scary because it seems like I'm going to have to confront parts of myself. The idea that I should change may mean on some level that I'm not so great right now. Striving for shleimus means I'm not shalim right now. Kalman spoke a little bit about emphasizing in many ways many of our positive attributes and positive traits. But I guess as almost like a charge or a source of chizuk, what would the Rabbanim say to encourage someone who says, it just seems too daunting? It seems like Mussar is all-encompassing. It seems like it requires a lot of time, a lot of investment, a lot of emotional strength and energy. And for a lot of people, and the Rabbanim here work with a range of people, from Rabbanim to people in yeshiva to people who are professionals, for a lot of them, they're very busy and it just seems scary. I guess, what would the Rabbanim share with such people about why it is, why invest and enter that world of Mussar? If it seems a little bit scary, it seems like it's very time-consuming, it seems like it's very, very demanding in ways that are increasingly challenging for people who at least feel like they're very, very busy.
It's scary in a way that's already familiar to all of us. There are people in this room who are physicians or who are pre-med students. It's very scary to be a pre-med student. There's a lot of years ahead of you. There's a lot of studies. But every time you knock off one level, one more course required, done. Yeah, it was scary. Yeah, it was difficult. But it's a tremendous feeling of reward. It's a tremendous feeling. And then as you get another course and another course, and then you get into medical school, and then you get into the rotations, that scariness gradually goes down because you have a tremendous feeling of accomplishment. So I don't think there's really anything more scary about undertaking a path of Mussar growth than there is in undertaking any other serious endeavor in life. And every one of those serious endeavors looks really daunting at the beginning, and then gradually it's a little less, and a little less. And we're all doing this. We're all doing it in one area or another. If we're Torah students, So it's very difficult to finish that first Masechta, but if it's finished, then lo and behold, there's a great sense of enthusiasm and embrace as you go on to the next Masechta. So you're a Torah student, you're a pre-med student, or you're not any professional, you're raising kids, and so you're raising your first child. Very scary, indeed. But lo and behold, there's another child. You have some practice behind you. It's not as scary, difficult, but not as scary. So I don't think the undertaking of a Musar path of growth is different. But then you say to me, well, where do you have time? So I think the real issue on time isn't so much putting in a lot of time as it is putting in steady time. There's a big difference. A lot of time can be an hour a day, 2 hours a day, 3 hours a day, 20 hours a week. The critical issue is steady. 5 minutes a day makes a huge difference. The altar of Kelm used to have in the yeshiva, used to have a 5 minute Seder. The idea was to teach people discipline. They'd come, they had to open up the Sefer and be very serious about it for 5 minutes. Okay, so David Jaffe was making reference, if I can take a point of personal privilege, I wrote this two sforim on the Grah. I wrote them over the course of minutes, minutes here and minutes there and minutes the other way. You talk about time. People have a ton of time. Everybody has hours. You're waiting in, you're in a taxi driving along, you're on the bus, you're waiting in line. The doctor is not on time and you're in the doctor's office and you're there an extra 20 minutes. If people think about all the time, we have a lot of time. And so the steadiness, a few minutes at a time, understanding that what is scary becomes less scary and what is difficult becomes rewarding. When a person can actually have a little less anger, when a person can have a little bit more focus, when a person can be a little bit more successful, tremendous sense of reward. Musar is a process of reward, as you were saying, you know, looking at the old sheets and comparing them to the new sheets. It's a tremendous sense of reward. So I think the time factor, if we understand how much time we have, the reward factor, it's all doable. It depends really on will. And just one final word, this business of Sforim and Musar Sforim. There are a lot of beautiful Musar Sforim out there, and there's a tremendous amount of wisdom, but a person has to understand, to be part of the Musar process, there's no obligation to like one particular Musar Sefer just because it happens to be a classic. It could be that that classic is for you, but if it isn't, it doesn't make a difference. Just move on to the next one. The dead Rebbe is still a Rebbe you choose. My Musar Sefer is Orchos Tzadikim. Other people may not relate to it. That's fine. Rav Nekras, he used to love Chovos HaLevavos. You know, he for decades, he just poured over that. For other people, it doesn't speak to them. That's okay. So as a person undertakes, finds the time, understands the reward, looks for a safer, it's okay to shop around when it comes for a safe.
I sometimes wonder if the Yetzirah wants us to look at Avodas Hashem as a burden. Something I have to do, I've got to be Yotzi, and if not, Gehenna's waiting for me on the other side. I want to propose another model. Here's the model I'd like to propose. I'll give it to you in two different versions. First version is this. Would you like to go on an adventure? I have a guide. I guarantee your safety. We'll do all sorts of amazing things. You want to summit a peak in New Zealand? We're going to do it. You want to see what the view looks like from the top of Everest? We'll be there. You want to see what it's like 500 feet under the Pacific Ocean, yours. Enormous adventure, and you will see things that you'll want to make a bracha on. You'll be so moved. Don't think of the Musar process as an all. Think of it as an extraordinary adventure where you're going to see things inside of yourself that are thrilling. Which makes me want to segue to the second version of this story. We live in a high-tech age. Imagine the following computer program, the following app. You sit down in front of it, you put your fingerprint or it reads your eyes, and your profile pops up. And then the app starts showing you yourself 5 years from now, and 10 years from now, and 15, and 20, and 25. I may have Esri. And in all these different situations, it allows you to customize what your reaction is going to be, how you'll react in this situation. And you can build any profile that you want. And by making these adjustments in each scene that the computer program presents to you, you craft your personality. And at the end, if you sit down in front of the machine for half an hour, at the end of half an hour, you have crafted this you that is the dream. And then you press a button and the printer pops out a little ticket that says, okay, you can be this. Now just start learning Musar. So it's not anything to be afraid of, and it's not an all. As Rabbi Goldberg said, the time commitment is minuscule. The students that I have that learn Musar the most on planet Earth learn for 30 minutes a day. The vast majority of my Talmidim learn 10 to 20 minutes of Musar a day. The total amount of time that's taken by practical avodos is like 2 to 3 minutes a day. 7 days a week, 365 days a year. But 2 to 3 minutes a day, 7 days a week, 365, it adds up. Revolva said, every great mountain is made up of billions of tiny grains of sand. So it doesn't require moving giant bricks. And it's the most exciting adventure you'll ever go on. And it's exactly what you want. You can become anyone that you want to become. You can become who the Ribono Shel Olam believes you can become. So the Yetzer says it's a scary process. He's lying. He doesn't like you. Don't believe him. I like you. Believe me.
The vision's beautiful. We'll see you in the journey in the top. And that really is the vision of who do you want to be in the year 2040 that sits before everybody. That's the joy of figuring out how to craft ourselves. That's the greatest creativity we can have. Just to present a different aspect of the tapestry here, I think Rav Hillel's presented something very beautiful, Rav Leib's presented. I'll make the third part that it's scary, it's overwhelming. Rav Yisrael Salanter was very concerned about this. Michtav Yud is the one I would say to start with. Michtav Zayin and Vav are very concerned with these issues of how can we do, what can happen. And he suggests just one tool, and the tool is that we all feel, forget change, forget what's going to be in 2040. You have ideals that you know you're not living. So in Michtav Yud, he says there, this was Rabbi Akiva's problem. Rabbi Akiva had an ideal to be a tzaddik. He couldn't figure out how to do it out. So he did a very simple process, very deep process. With Yisrael Salanter explains it and how it works. But he says just what Rabbi Yisrael did was he brought the Rabbi Akiva Maimer from Avos Reb Nosson and said, just like water dropping in a stone wears away the stone, so too Musar on me wears away the boulders and the blockages I have in myself. And he suggests a person should just sit down and read a mimer of Chachma, and let that mimer slowly become internalized and slowly become connected to you yourself. It takes 5 minutes a day, and it's intellectual and enjoyable to grow with. And if you do that, we know that drop after drop of water changes you inside, and all of a sudden, one of your ideals that you've always had becomes closer to you, more connected to you. That's not scary. That's what I want to do for myself. And it changes me in profound, profound ways. We all speak English now. I'm a little nervous next to Rev Hillel. Rev Hillel's house used to be the place that I went for warmth and care and the best English academic library I knew of in Sanhedrin Rechevet. And also for his coming over to me and writing half an hour every day and saying, is this sentence right? Is that sentence right? So I'm a little afraid to craft the intellectual idea in front of Rav Hillel. But this concept of taking words and living those words and bring them into yourself, that's something that's not scary. What's scary is that I've got words and I've got me and we're different. I'm not holistic, I'm not complete. That's the greatest fear in a person's life and what turns a person down. And a simple way to sit down and do this is Rev Yisrael's repeating a Maimer Chazal. You can look, if that's too frum for you, take a look at Benjamin Franklin's autobiography and sit down and read his 13 goals. If you want to go more, take a look at Cheshbon HaNefesh, with the introduction of Rav Isaac Sher, and read his 13 traits over there. My real suggestion would be to have someone learn with you Reb Volba's Vadim on any meter you want to work on, and to learn that once on a Friday for 40 minutes and then a Chazaret for 10 minutes, 5 minutes the rest of the week. At least to myself, I found that that profoundly changes a person over time. It's something we're all striving for. It's something we all want. It's an intellectual process, and it's solving the problem of the generation that I've got ideas in my head, but they don't get to my heart. How do I get there? I think that Musar tool and starting to change then opens you up to all change from there on in.
I want to thank Rabbi Turetsky for penetrating questions.
I really just want to express Hakar Satov, certainly on behalf of me, but everybody here. To the Ravanim who have taken time out of enormously busy schedules, people whose not just days but hours and minutes are spent with a certain degree of real focus and awareness. It's been wonderful and I really appreciate that so much. Anybody that is interested, in the back of the room, they're going to be selling Rabbi Goldberg's books. I know that books, Sfarim, I know that for myself and so many others, they expose us to ideas about the world of Musar. They introduce us to some fascinating figures, and they help us in some of the most rigorous areas of Torah, like Hilchos Mikvaos and Kol Yitzchak Tzveika. The range is a Musar shmooze in and of itself, and it's certainly, really just want to thank them and all are, I guess, encouraged to check out this farm on the way out.
I just say a couple of things that I neglected in the beginning. Thank you to my brother Matis, my brother-in-law Gabi, and to Reuven Falman for the videos and the pictures. Thank you really to everyone here for coming from near and far. In particular, one of the most uncomfortable parts of the raising this event was reaching out to some very chashuv people in Rabbanim, you know, letting them know about the event, but not having asked them to speak. In particular, I just want to acknowledge the presence of my Rosh Kollel, Rav David Miller, who wasn't here when I started. There's really many great people in this room. Thank you, Joey Turetsky, for promoting the books. It doesn't come naturally to me. Certainly doesn't come naturally to my father. Last week, he spoke in Yeshiva Torah Traga, and the other thank you I forgot, which is really an apology, is to my father for agreeing to this whole event taking place in the first place. I didn't have to twist his arm to make it happen, but I think it is fair to say that for his whole trip that he was here in Israel these 2 weeks is pretty much the last thing on the priority list. I hope what I did is a fulfillment of Kibbutz Ava'im and not the opposite. But in Yeshiva Torah Shraga, so afterwards, I said that there are some books if people wanted to buy. And my father got up and said, if anyone wants to buy, it's very nice, but please make sure that if you don't buy, you don't walk out with a guilty conscience. Which itself, I think, it says something about the reasons why to buy the books. But thank you very much.